Good evening, welcome. I think most of you were here last week. For those who weren't, we're picking up this next section of the Lankavatara Sutra, looking at what's called the three natures, or Red Pine calls them the three modes of reality, or sometimes called the three characteristics of all phenomena. And we looked at the section on page 99 last week. I just wanted to follow up with one piece about that, and that second paragraph of section 23, I confirmed that the Sanskrit, it says, where it says, attachment to name involves attachment to the individual and shared characteristics of these external and internal entities, which I thought might be Svalakshana and Samanyalakshana, and it is indeed. We grasp individual characteristics. Svalakshana are like, in direct perception, we directly meet the appearances of sensory objects. That's like the Svalakshana, without any conceptual mediation. And Samanyalakshana is like the general or generic characteristics of things that are the way we conceptually know things.
What's an example of that?
That would be like a generic image of something. Like, so the Zendo, if we look, we directly perceive the colors and shapes of this Zendo. We can see a Svalakshana of this specific Zendo in this moment. But then if we close our eyes and imagine the Zendo, or if we're at home and somebody says, what's a Zendo look like? We, like, our mind immediately can conjure up a generic image of a Zendo. You know, it's like, it's a room with walls and a ceiling, and it probably has an altar and some cushions in it. It's kind of like, we're not actually seeing specific characteristics in direct perception. It's completely imaginary. And so it's like a generic Zendo that we can imagine is Samanyalakshana. So the part here was, it's talking about names and appearances. Attachment to names and appearances is one way of talking about the so-called imagined reality, or the purely imagined nature of all phenomena, is grasping or attachment to to names and appearances. And attachment to appearance involves attachment to external and internal entities, or dharmas. And attachment to name involves attachment to the individual and shared characteristics of these external and internal dharmas. So kind of generally speaking, the appearances are just phenomena, and then more, you know, if we look more closely, we're grasping the names of phenomena. And here, this is kind of unique to the sutra, but attachment to names, the Buddha says here, means attachment to these specific characteristics, like colors and sounds and stuff, in direct perception, and also attachment to general images. I think especially general images we know involve names, like this example of, like, what does a Zendo look like? We almost need a name to come up with a general characteristic of a Zendo. Yes?
So, general characteristics, makes an abstraction.
Yeah, an abstraction.
Mm-hmm. And that abstraction has to have a name associated with it, obviously.
So. Yes, exactly. Yep, yep. And but these are, interestingly, like the are abstract images of cushions and altars that are in all Zendos. They are actually characteristics of a Zendo. Isn't that kind of interesting? Even though we're just imagining them, they're lakshana. Their characteristics or appearances is how Red Pine translates lakshana. Yes.
It's just a little contrast between the generic and the specific that our judgment comes up.
Oh, excuse me, just for people who caught that last bit, Red Pine doesn't translate lakshana as appearances, it's nimitta as appearances. But the lakshana are the characteristics. And your name, your question was the connection between what names?
Between the specific and the generic. When we come up with car.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see a specific car, is that where the comparison comes up in the judgment? Of nice car, or what's a nice car, big car, or small.
I think we could say like we learn about general characteristics of cars by experiencing specific. I think we need some specific. We need to actually directly experience some cars, some characteristics of cars, before we can conjure up an image of one, at least in a picture or whatever. So you could say we start building our deluded world from specific characteristics, and then we further conceptualize on that and get into the general ones. But I think most of our grasping and attachment involves these generic images. But I think he's saying here, I think this is kind of nice because he's saying there can be this attachment even in direct perception of svalakshanas, of these specific characteristics that are seen in direct perception of colors. It's the sense objects, colors, sounds, smells, that he's just being really inclusive of how far grasping can go in terms of these kind of teachings. And I would say the reason that it's an imagined grasping of color, this is the mind-only tradition, is because we're grasping it as external to mind. So this might not be emphasized in earlier teachings, but in this mind-only tradition, even in the direct perception of a color, blue, there's a very subtle sense of dualism, even in direct perception, even in that when meeting that specific characteristic, blue, without any conceptualization, there's still a sense that it's out there, apart from the mind, external to mind. So therefore, he's saying here, when defining this imaginary imputational character, it's the attachment to this individual, the specific characteristics as well as the general characteristics. Yes.
When we make an imputation, though, we're going. Our primary source is our abstraction,
mm-hmm.
and we impute that into the special case. And often, that special case then is evaluated against our ideal abstraction.
I think that's all in the realm of the general characteristics.
Though. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we might find ourselves putting evaluating what is actually appearing in its own terms, and judging it's falling short compared to our assessment of what it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I think there's judgment possible. In my own situation, when I try to make a special case out of my general sense.
Yeah, well, that's another thing, is that we see a generic image and we think that we're actually seeing the thing in and of itself. It's almost impossible to have just, you know, really see, like we look at an object like this and it's almost impossible to bypass the general characteristic of like the conceptual ideas about a watch, and to just see the colors and shape without the idea of a watch. I mean, maybe when we first open our eyes and look at it, for a split second, there's just color and shape, but then almost immediately we know it's a watch, and that's, now we've kind of like, it's getting blurry. Our direct perception of it is, blurry is not quite the right word, but it's like, the vivid direct perception of it is kind of being diminished by our conceptual overlay, even just slightly, if not a lot.
A person who's ever seen a digital watch, only a mechanical watch, might say that's not a watch.
Yeah. So, it's not a watch. I was at the Everyday Dharma Zen Center downtown giving the Dharma talk this morning on these three natures, because it's what I've been thinking about. And I brought up the example because I had the watch. It's that for people who've never seen a watch before, it's not a watch. And afterwards, somebody who grew up in really rural Mexico said, I forget if it was her grandfather or father, really had not seen a watch before, and really like didn't know what it was when he'd seen one. And they're like, that's what we used to tell time with. And he's like, huh? You just look at the sun. So there are, it's not a watch. Now you could say for that person, it still is an object. They don't know what it is, but it's still an object apart from their mind. And that's maybe what we're kind of like making the distinction. They directly perceive some colors and shapes. It's kind of nice to not know what it is because they more directly experience it. They see the svalakshana of it. But even then, the Buddha is saying, that's still called the imaginary nature. Before we conceptually imagine that it's a watch, just to see it as a color and shape existing apart from the mind is also a very subtle form of imaginary character. It's dualistically separate from the mind. Yes?
How does this, or does it apply to the adjustment that we begins as a concept? When we, in theory, say, quickly open our eyes and recognize that person is angry, or this person is feeling love, or my child is upset. So they're not, we've been talking about car, zendo, watch, what we consider to be physical phenomena.
Yeah.
Recognition of things that we would think of as being conceptual entities, but also physical entities.
But I think those are, reading someone's emotion. We're seeing that we're making a conceptual image, even if it's instantly, and we can do it very easily without a lot of so-called thought. We can see somebody's expression. But as soon as we determine that that's an angry expression, that's the conceptual version. But we're building that from specific characteristics of slight turns of the corner of the mouth and things like this. It's amazing how our minds can do this. As from childhood, very easily we learn to do this. It's amazing. And then this is, and that's, it's very good that we can do that, and it helps us create an amazing world. And then the sutra is kind of like looking at the process of how we do all that and kind of saying, let's look closer. We take all that for granted. It's like, well, that's real. They really are angry. And they really are a person with a mouth or whatever. But it's starting to like question all of that in this sutra. Because, not that we stop doing that, but just that if we can question it really deeply and see how we're constructing even colors and sounds and so on, then there's the possibility to be more and more released from grasping all these objects in the way that we think they are. So, moving on to section LV 60, no, 55, is that? Is LV 55?
Yes.
We the construction of Roman numerals is a kind of like dying, almost extinct way of reading numbers. And for those who want to, check out the whole form, this introduction to the three natures, there's some nice stuff in there. You can listen to that class on the website. So now, this is continuing, this next section, the verses on the three modes of reality, the imagined, the dependent, and the perfected. As we start to get into this somewhat complex description here, just a little review of one point that's maybe when studying these before, we didn't talk about this. The imaginary nature, or the imputational nature, I think we could call the projected nature, is that, reified, complete imaginations and so on, imaginary nature. And then the dependent nature, one part of the dependent nature is its projecting capacity. So this word, and one of the five dharmas that we're going to hear in the next section is projections. And it's very easy to that sounds like the imaginary. So let's just, that if we have to fit that into one of these three natures, that must be the imaginary, the projected nature. But my understanding, and this is confirmed in other of these Indian texts too, it's a kind of subtle point here that the projected samkalpa in Sanskrit is an aspect of the other dependent nature. Projections, that's what I meant to say. Projections, samkalpa, is part of the other dependent nature. The projected is the imaginary. Or we could also say, other dependent is like imagining. It's like the verb, right? Imagining, projecting, and then the participle, did we say? The object that's imagined is the imaginary, or the imagined. The object that's projected is the projected, and that's the projected nature. So there's the mind's function of projecting. That's not what's reifying things. That's just a function of mind, that we project stuff. We imagine stuff. But then the object that's imagined to be an object, we're projecting this watch, that's just the other dependent, but the projected watch as an object, as a real object, that's the imaginary, imagined nature. We imagine a watch, that's just a function of the mind, an other dependent function of the mind, dependently arising appearance of things is like imagining things. And then there's the imagined. Another way to say it would be like a thought. We're thinking of a zendo. That thought itself is just an other dependent appearance arising from mind. But then the imagined, the thought of zendo, like the content of the thought, zendo, that's the imputational nature, the imagined nature. Can you follow that? It's kind of a strange point, but important, that's going to come up in this section here.
Well, if we look at the eighth consciousness, the Alaya, intersecting with the sixth, that activity between, could that be said to be what you're talking about here, in the other dependent?
Yeah, that would be from the last class we had on the eight consciousnesses. Yeah, that would be the consciousness description of how we project things, is from the storehouse consciousness, the great, you know, unknown, unconscious mind of all our karmic tendencies that have all these seeds for experiencing watches and zendos and stuff, that a seed comes up from that, sprouts out of this storehouse of, in the form of a thought. The seed sprouts of a thought of a watch. And it's just that's a sixth consciousness thought arising from the eighth consciousness. And then we have one way to talk about it would be like the seventh consciousness, that's the one that's the bifurcator that splits it into things. You could say the seventh consciousness is what creates the imagined nature of a real watch. And this kind of description is a nice way to apply this to Zazen practice, right? Because we say like thoughts are arising in Zazen, like Uchiyama Roshi says, it's like our stomach is secreting juices and our mind is secreting thoughts, right? It's like that's not such a problem in and of itself. That's just the natural function of mind. Those are other dependent phenomena, meaning they're arising dependent on past seeds in the storehouse consciousness. And they're just appearances. They're not real. They're just dependently arisen mere appearances, mere mind. When we say mind only, this is the mind that we're talking about is the other dependent character. But then in Zazen, a thought arises like that mind secretion, and then we like say the thought arises like, I'm really like not so good at Zazen. Have you ever had that thought arise during Zazen? I can't concentrate. That's just an other dependent thought. It's beautiful, amazing thing that the mind can just percolate up. That thought, I'm not so good at Zazen. But then, almost immediately, usually, we grasp the content of the thought and believe it to be real. That thought means I'm really not so good at Zazen. It's true. And that's like a reality. And that's the other dependent appearing thought now being solidified into the projected nature of that thought. The thought's a projection, and then the projected is now the reality of the fixed belief, I am not good at Zazen, and then we're suffering. So this is often how we think about Zazen, is you just let the thoughts come up, but you don't reify them, or sometimes we say you don't believe in the content. You could say the thought itself is like the other dependent character. The content of the thought is like the imputational character.
So we have this thing. This appears to our senses.
Yes, it appears.
And we turn and we go, it's a book.
Yeah, right? It's a book. We use the name connects with the appearance.
Yeah. So let's say it's a book. It's a sacred book. It's a very sacred book. And let's say now there's a big disaster and there's no power in any place. And we have to make a fire. And somebody says, that's not a book, that's kindling. It's a fire starter.
Yeah.
Where is the shift between sacred book that we can't let sit on the floor, mm-hmm. and that which has pages we can rip out to make a fire? Where is the shift in there?
Well, those are both conceptual ideas. We're using names connected with appearances, the nama connected with the nimitta. And you could say the appearance, say, why are they different? You have two names for the same thing. It's kind of interesting, huh?
I think in the area of the other dependent, it's kind of a dynamic thing that says, for now, this is kindling.
Yeah. The other dependent is very flexible.
Yeah.
In that
so
way.
That's a dynamic place.
Yeah.
The actual assignment is being made.
Yeah.
As opposed to, this is and always will be a book.
Yeah.
Is that a
Yeah. Yeah, the other dependent. I mean, other dependent is also defined as dependent co-arising, where it's total potential, total flexibility, nothing's fixed, it's all just appearance, mirage-like appearance. It's still deluded from the perspective of the perfect nature, the thoroughly established nature, but it's just like the magical display of this world. It's not really like such a problem. I think maybe last class I had the thought that, you know, if we, you know, just the other dependent being the other dependent, 95% of all our problems are, you know, dropped away. But there's still, that 5% is still like, there's a little, it's a little bit off from the perspective of Buddha's perfect wisdom. If we're still the appearances are assaulting us, and maybe there's, if the appearance gets strong enough, if we're like, it's just illusory appearances, but if it gets strong enough, we're going to be like, but not that one. That one's bothering me. So, you know, even to get to that point, right, would be kind of quite something. So then we have this perfect nature that's the or consummate nature or accomplished nature, thoroughly established nature, that's the absence of not only all the imaginations, but also the absence of even the appearances. Particularly in this sutra, in the Sandhi Nirmochana, it doesn't emphasize so much the absence of the appearances, but this one seems to do that. The other nice image that we brought up last time, metaphor, classic Indian metaphor, that I think it's good, even if you heard it before, I think I've said before, it's one of my favorite metaphors because it's there's so much packed in here, is the snake. You're walking at dusk in the garden and you see a snake on the path. You jump back in fright and your adrenaline's flowing because it's a poisonous snake, you think. And then you get a little curious. So in a way, you're suffering. You're already like, you have a problem that there's a snake there. But then you take out your flashlight, your wisdom flashlight, and you start shining it on the snake to examine it more closely. And you see that it's actually just a rope. It's not a snake. So this is like Asanga uses this metaphor for these three natures. He says that the rope is the other dependent nature. It's an appearance of something there. And then this imagination, this fixed imputation is the snake. We really believe it's a snake based on this appearance of something there. But then when we look closer, we kind of undo the imputation, the imagination of the snake, and we're relieved. The nice thing about this metaphor, I think, is that the fear is like instantly dissipated as soon as we see that it's not what we thought it was. It's just a rope. We're just like this sigh of relief. It's like a little enlightenment, right? It's not what I thought it was. It's just a rope. And the other nice part about the metaphor is that you never have to kill the snake. And you don't have to destroy your imputations. You don't have to obliterate your imaginations. You don't have to get a lobotomy. We gotta just stop believing that these are watches and stuff. It's more like you just look closely, not necessarily visually look, just with our wisdom eye, look more closely and see that we don't really remove the watch from this. We just see that it's not the watch that we think it is, that it's a mere appearance of something that we're... It's, of course, very hard to do this compared to a garden hose because we're so used to seeing this as a watch. But it's through these teachings, actually, is the way, is one way to start deconstructing our imaginations. So in the classic metaphor, it's a little funny. I'll just let you know what Asanga does with this. He says, because we've got the third one, right? What's the perfect nature, the consummate nature in this example? He says that it's actually that you look even more closely and it's not a rope. It's actually just strands of fiber woven together. So I think in that metaphor, these are just metaphors, right? But in that metaphor, it's like this three levels or kind of gradations of illusion. The snake is really illusory. The rope relieves us, and that's what we think of as like, now we're like, it really is a rope. It really is. This appearance of the rope is what's real. But then we look closer and we see that is just a mere appearance of a rope. It's actually just strands of fiber. The rope itself is another conceptual construction, right? It's just less diluted. So I think that's what he's pointing to with saying the strands of the rope. But strands of rope are a little different from the thoroughly established nature. I think thoroughly established natures we would more define as the absence of the snake in the rope. The fact that there's no snake in the rope is maybe a more usual, clear way to talk about the perfect nature. It's about an absence. It's about non-delusion. It's emptiness. That's why emptiness is an absence of something, also called suchness. So now we're remembering again the three natures. I think it's good to go through these different examples, because now Buddha's going to like start talking from all different angles about these three. The Buddha then repeated the meaning of this in verse. And actually, if you look at this previous section in the sutra, it doesn't have much to do with this. So, we're not looking at the previous part. It's more like he's commenting on this earlier section on the handout here. Okay, when the mind is tied to external realms, and you might remember from last class, this is Vishaya in Sanskrit, which usually means objects. Objects is like external realms. Objects compared to the subject. When the mind is tied to external realms or objects, knowledge is subject to speculation. Where freedom from projection prevails, impartial wisdom rises. In this case, knowledge is jnana, and impartial wisdom is prajna, but they're virtually the same. When the mind is tied to external realms, when it's projecting things outside of itself, knowledge, or kind of wisdom knowledge, becomes subject to conceptual speculation. And where freedom from projections of externality prevails, impartial wisdom arises. Maybe we could say non-dual wisdom. What exists in imagined reality, in dependent reality, doesn't. Imagined reality is what is grasped. Dependent reality is not imagined. So, what exists in imagined reality is an actual watch here, an imagined, imputed, thoroughly imagined, but seemingly real. That's the funny thing, right? We call it the imagined nature, but the imagined nature, as we experience it, is what seems like total reality. It's like this solid world is our experience of our sense of reality is what we call thoroughly imagined in mind only. So we have this thoroughly imagined but seemingly totally real watch here. What exists here in dependent reality doesn't exist. So in dependent reality, it's just a mere appearance of colors and shapes and tactile sensations that we're creating a watch out of. Imagined reality is what is grasped. The watch is what is grasped. Right? Dependent reality is not imagined. Now, we could add a little footnote, dependent reality is imagination. Dependent reality is imagining, is included in dependent reality, but dependent reality is not imagined. Are you following this point, this distinction between imagining, just free-flowing secretions of imagining, versus imagined?
One has attribution and the other is just flowing.
Flowing, yeah, just like a dream of imagining a world. And, you know, in our experience, we almost can't separate them. Our imagining produces the imagined world. But this is what we're kind of trying to do, is saying, let's look more at the imagining rather than just fixating on the imagined.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Given number two, I have a little trouble with the translation of number one. Number one is when the mind is tied to external realms. Given number two, would it be just as good a translation, technically, to say when the mind imagines external realms?
Yeah. And tied has that sense of attached.
Tied, as that there really is something like external.
Yeah.
Realm,
mm-hmm.
And we got a rope connected to it.
Yeah, so, but that's
so
the meaning.
So when the mind mm-hmm. imagines external realms, knowledge is subject to speculation.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Okay.
The way it's tied to external realms is through imagination.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Three is where a myriad distinctions arise like illusions, or maya, Sanskrit, they aren't real. Where characteristics multiply because they're projections, they aren't perfect. Follow now, this is quite straightforward, is what we've been talking about. And perfect here is talking about this third nature, right? The perfect nature. Because they're projections, they aren't perfect. Again, I appreciate that projections, right? It's samkalpa, is this. If we every time we read that in here, I will propose that that's an aspect of the other dependent. And then imagined nature. Yeah, imagined reality is parikalpita. Samkalpa is just like in English, is like the verbal form of imagining. So samkalpa is, it's that kalpa is imagining, and kalpita is the object that is imagined. And then pari means thoroughly, completely, like pari nirvana. Complete nirvana. So samkalpa is just in there, doesn't add so much meaning to it. Samkalpa is the imagining, as he translates as projections. Parikalpita is the completely projected thing. So he's helping us here by calling one projections and one imagined nature. And there's, you know, one's other dependent and one's imputational.
So by perfect, he's not talking about the best of all possible.
No, it's just...
He's saying ultimate there.
Yeah, parinishpana.
So ultimate entails no characteristics.
No, that's right, no characteristics. Yeah.
So if they have characteristics of any kind, then that's not ultimate.
That's right. And I mentioned last week, too, that he translates parinishpana as perfected reality, and I would like to call it... I think that's a little off, because that sounds like it's something that's not perfect that you have then perfected, where I think perfect works okay, but it's, you know, beginninglessly perfect. It's not like it's... It's not like it's made, it's not like it's perfected through your practice. The perfect nature of things is the way that they always have been and always will be, free from all our imaginations. Consummate, thoroughly established. the way that they don't come and go.
So it's not so clear to me.
Which part?
Number three.
Mm-hmm.
There's four or five parts here.
Mm-hmm.
Where myriad distinctions arise. What's that?
So that's like when discriminations, where we're saying, it's like the world of multiplicity of characteristics and appearances. This is a watch, this is a recorder, this is a platform. Yeah, so distinctions.
When we distinguish something, we grab it pretty tightly.
And we make it a thing as opposed to other things. We separate thing.
So it's a projected thing.
Yeah, so it's bringing another word there.
So it's an imagined thing.
Yeah, the world of multiplicity of things is is the realm of, in a way, the realm of both the other dependent appearances of myriad things and the world of imagined real things. But in the perfect nature, there aren't multiple things. In emptiness, there aren't form and feelings and perceptions, formations and multiple things. This is like merging of difference and unity, right? If there is, that poem's about the way that they do interpenetrate, but we have these terms, unity, where we usually think of no multiplicity, and multiplicity, where there's no unity. And I think we call the perfect reality is the realm of unity. But not like one thing, just no distinctions or multiplicity. Mm-hmm.
Would an example of that be
I think in all these examples, we'd have to look really closely at exactly what's going on, right? I think the one that maybe is closest is when sitting in zazen, when we're really, maybe for once in a while, like there's just no conceptual thinking at all, and like there's nothing happening for a moment, and there's no self and other, and there's no imagination of anything. I think we can, I think we have experiences of the thoroughly established in zazen. I think they're walking down the street when we're more active and we're actually, our eyes are open and we're seeing things. I would propose just offhand that, but we're like really present and we're not adding anything to it and it's beautiful. Or maybe like in sesshin when you walk out of the zendo and it's like there's a luminous world. Because we're not reifying it so much. I would say that is like the other dependent appearances, virtually free from all the imputations. So there's still appearances. We're still seeing appearances of trees and stuff, but they're so wonderful to see, and we feel very little sense of separation, if any. But in the thoroughly established, there aren't even the appearances of trees. And I think that could happen in zazen. You're not, And maybe you could have your eyes open, but it's like the sensory world is not actually entering, even.
I sometimes suspect it can still happen in other ways, too, somehow. It just feels like it.
Well,
like the moment that a child cries and you pick it up, and everything's gone in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing happening.
Well, I think that one way to look at it too, if we say that it's still the world of mere appearances, there are forget if it's in this sutra, but there are places where it's talked about this, how from the perspective of when realizing the thoroughly established or perfect nature, then you see that it's actually not separate from the appearances. And then you can have appearances because you realize that the nature of appearances is the perfect nature. In other words, the true nature of the other dependent appearances is that there's nothing there, really. There's really nothing there. And yet they appear. So, and that's maybe also what the poem Merging of Difference and Unity may be about, is that unity is merged with appearances with no fixation at all. The imputational is not operating at all. So,
no particularity.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this could be where bodhisattvas can work, is that through realizing, even before realizing the perfected nature, but when getting more and more familiarity, or really knowing that that's the nature of things, is that they're not even how they appear, then the appearances, we can live in the world of appearances, and that's where bodhisattvas live. That's where they help people. But the story, the traditional story, is for a Buddha, after all these bodhisattva stages where they're helping people, a Buddha doesn't even give rise to appearances anymore. And that's like the Dharmakaya. And that's like, to talk about that is almost futile because it's completely inconceivable to us. But I don't think we need to worry about eliminating all appearances before we've saved all beings. Because then we wouldn't be able to. Now, a Buddha's Dharmakaya could maybe help beings in a way that we don't understand how it can do that. Even though it doesn't perceive appearances, it can respond in an inconceivable way to appearing beings. But we don't need to do that today.
What does it mean where characteristics multiply?
I think it's virtually the same as myriad distinctions.
But then it says because their projection.
Yeah.
Which is more of a dependent.
Mm-hmm. Characteristics, I would say, are, I think it's lakshana there. Characteristics are appearances. So I think that the first seems more like when the imputational is operating like illusion, it isn't real. Mm-hmm. I would say the second one is more like when the other dependent is operating and its projections, even that is also not the perfected. That's a nice point. That would be my understanding here, is that they're actually all three natures are included in there. The first one is the imagined, the myriad distinctions of the imagined nature. They aren't the perfect nature. But even where the characteristics appearing in other dependent reality as projections, even they aren't the perfect nature either. The other dependent nature is not the perfect nature. That's nice. That's how I would, if we look at that carefully, that's how I would understand it.
What I read there, and maybe incorrect, is that there's the operation of making a lot of different objects, which is a myriad distinctions. And that each object then has its what appears to be its nature, that those are the characteristics. Could that be a good reading of that?
It could be. We could also say that, myriad distinctions we could also see as other dependent distinctions arising as just like characteristics multiplying. It's not really specified here. In all these verses, it's not like when you read this whole section, it doesn't seem to me like Buddha is making this really particular strict point that's then the next one is building on the previous. He's just kind of like, all these words are just flowing out. Yeah. And they're poetic verses, so they're probably trying to rhyme in Sanskrit and stuff.
Well, so we have the Zendo.
Yeah.
One, and then we break it up into windows and the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what's the difference between a window and a wall? Well, then you get a characteristics. Well, the window opens and the wall doesn't.
And that's also making distinctions.
It's also making distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that would be another way to understand it, is that both myriad distinctions and, you know, there's this relationship between the other dependent and the imputational. I have this very intimate relationship, right? And even when thinking and talking about it, it's constantly shifting back and forth between the two. The way that they work together actually creates our, you know, delusion and attachment. And to actually like pull them apart, I think we kind of can in the way we're talking about it, but they're particularly this way that we're talking about now, the projecting and the projections, right, are completely, they're so close, and yet we can make that distinction. And even to say, like, is this going to go on in these verses, which comes from which? I had always understood it as the other dependent nature actually gives rise to the imputations and imaginations, but there's some stuff in here that almost making it sound like imaginations are creating, you know, the appearances. So
I'm thinking of 12 Angry Men as a script, and the Crucible, you know, where imputations and imaginations actually created a reality that was totally false, that had huge consequences for the people involved.
Another way we could say that is like, because we have an imagination that this really is a watch, then we can collectively create appearances, like in the culture, we can all agree on these like other dependent ideas about watches, thoughts about watches, from believing that there really are fixed watches, which would be the imputational. From that, we can have thoughts, other dependent thoughts about watches. So that would be another way where other dependent phenomena could arise from imputational. Yes?
Science says that our eyes are actually not very good. And so we see something and our mind fills in all the blanks that we don't even perceive, but we're quite sure we're seeing all this detail.
Yeah.
Over we have huge blind spots in each eye that we don't.
Yeah, that's the one I've heard about, is the blind spot really is where the nerve hooks in, right? We really don't see an image there, but the mind fills it in. Yeah.
And so this is actually a better way of seeing, a truer way of seeing.
Mm-hmm. And that would be another example too, about even in direct perception, it's still a little bit off. At the point of the blind spot, we're not really directly perceiving. I mean, yeah, what is direct perception? And then there's examples like cataracts or something. We're directly perceiving sky flowers in the illusory images in the air. We're not imagining them, and yet it's but this faulty sense organ, we're actually perceive them. So there's, yeah. Direct perception is not reliable either.
We were talking about this before, that actually the accumulation of all the senses only accounts for something like 20% or something like that.
Of experience?
Yeah, of what is actually happening, and the rest is all filled in by a committee member. In the mind.
Are you talking about the rest being conceptual or even just directly perceptual?
Yeah, well,
Conceptual, yeah. And it depends, you know, on, you know, time of day. And like in Zazen, we might get, the percentage might become more and more directly, more sensory based. But when we're like trying to read something and understand it, it might be very, the percentage of direct perception might go very down, or it's totally in this conceptual world. So probably changes.
But it's not just the eyes, it's everything.
Yeah.
And when you talk about 12 angry men, you know, and just the actual direct effects of these things, it's
huge.
Yeah, it's huge. Apparently with parole boards, the percentage of people that get paroled is pretty much the same, except for the case right before lunch. If you have the good fortune to be the person who's being paroled right before lunch, your percentage of being paroled like more than doubles.
Because they want to get to lunch more quickly. That's interesting. Yes.
Again, it's not necessarily bad, though, right? You can't have a situation where it's you again. You tell it has some purpose.
Sure. For if you happen to be the person who has the good fortune of being the case that comes right before lunch, it's pretty good for you.
Yeah, it's almost like we're not necessarily getting into like good and bad in this whole story. It's more about illusion and reality. And then in the end, maybe there is this underlying implication that reality is better than illusion, but the Buddha almost never says that.
We're trying not to qualify, we're just trying to examine.
Yeah, we're just examining how things work. But I think we could say one's more, you know, reality leads to a more free and easy life, and the more we're fixating on illusions, delusions, the more pain and sorrow there will be. But even now, we don't necessarily say good and bad.
Potential for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost inevitable potential. Like if we believe things are outside ourselves, as we said before, you know, we're like sitting ducks. Like we're just waiting for something to not go our way, and then there's a problem. And you know, there's all kinds of other Buddhist practices, of course, for just, you know, acceptance in general. It's like a big one. When things don't go our way, let's just practice, okay, it's okay, acceptance. But this is kind of like, this is going like right to the roots. You know, if we could really understand these type of teachings on a really deep level, it's like, it's not even a matter than practicing acceptance. It's more like with a snake and rope thing, right? It's like, well, there really is a snake there, but like I can accept that there's a snake there and I'll walk around it. Rather than like actually see that it's not a snake. Now I don't have to accept the snake anymore because it's not a snake. I just have to say, because I brought up that example this morning in this talk here. Somebody asked, well, what if it's a real snake? And I said, well, a real snake has three natures, right? It has an other dependent appearing nature of a snake. It has the imputational nature that it's really a snake outside us, and then it has this perfect, true nature of the snake that it's not a snake. So a real snake is actually not a snake.
I wonder if you'll be invited back.
And then they said, "Well, but do you run when you see it?" I said, yeah, it's okay to run. When, you know, I mean, it's okay to avoid the real snake because, I mean, the imagined snake, because we live in the world of appearances, and there's birth and death, and if it's a poisonous snake, there's there could be death involved, but death has three natures, right? but what about when it's real death? real death is no death, right? I mean, this is where we can, the more we understand this, the more we can apply it to. Maybe death is the biggest one we can apply it to, actually, right? It's not what we think it is. So, what exists in imagined reality?
Have we done four yet?
Oh, four. Characteristics are mistakes rising from a mind in bondage. Projections of what isn't known based on dependent reality. So there again, we were trying to figure out in the last verse whether characteristics are the imputational or the other dependent nature. Either way works. Characteristics, the marks of things. Well, if we want to really look back in that last section, the remember that attachment to name, which is the definition of the imputational character, involves attachment to individual and shared characteristics. So, attachment to characteristics is the definition, one definition of the imagined nature, the imputational nature. So, now we're just talking about characteristics without the attachment, though. So it's a little trick. We could say characteristics without attaching to them is just other dependent phenomena. I think I would go with that for now. Characteristics are but even though they're not attached to, they're still mistakes, right? They're appearing illusory, mirage-like mistakes, rising from a mind in bondage, projections of what isn't known based on dependent reality. Based on, we could say, as an aspect of emerging from dependent reality. Characteristics are arising from seeds in the storehouse consciousness. Storehouse consciousness is another name I would propose for the other dependent character. It's the kind of psychological name for the for this other dependent reality. It's the other dependence of all our tendencies. It's what gives rise to every experience we ever have. Yes.
Mistakes is a word that bothers me. Can I say instead of mistakes, use the word artificial?
I think mistake means like mistaken perception, like
mistaken to be real.
Mistaken to be real,
which is artificial. It's artificial.
But you're right. As other dependent phenomena, there's no such thing as mistakes. Dependent co-arising is free from mistakes by definition, because everything is just arising depending on conditions the way it must. There's no right and wrong in what arises. It's just what must arise according to the conditions of this moment.
So if we impute something to that pattern, and say that's a characteristic, we're actually creating, as if we were painting a picture, we're creating something that really is artificial.
Mm-hmm.
Not
I don't know if I like the word artificial, because it's a shared. You can say book, and each one of us has something in their mind. What the book is, it may not be real, but artificial, I don't know.
How about illusory?
We constructed our mind, though.
How about illusory? Characteristics are illusory. Like a mirage rising from a mind in bondage. Projections also are illusory of what isn't known based on dependent reality. What exists in the Red Pine has a note there that I thought was an interesting one. He said, and that the imagined doesn't come from the dependent. It is a misperception of it. And I don't know if I necessarily agree, but I thought that kind of shifted my view on a little bit, because I often do think of the imagined does come from the dependent. The like in our imagined. No, I could see that. No, I think this is good because I think he's right. It's the snake and the rope, right? The snake doesn't come from the rope. The snake doesn't like emerge out of the rope, right? It's just a misperception of it. Right? So the what leads to the imagined, which is imagination, that I think we could say does come from the other dependent. It comes from Alaya. It arises due to conditions, imagination. But the imagined, mm-hmm. I think that's good because it doesn't come from it because it's completely, it's not there, right? It's like a complete, you know, to come from something means it has to at least appear. But I think this, the imagined actually doesn't even, it's not an appearance. It's like a belief. It's like a...
That's why I say it's artificial. So there are people who see snakes and who aren't afraid. Who see, quote, real snakes who aren't afraid. There are people who see real snakes and are. There are people who see snakes that are really ropes but are afraid. Like that tells me that the root of our fear is, in a sense, artifice. It's made up.
And it depends on our karmic tendencies, what we're afraid of,
yeah.
On our unique alaya.
But those karmic tendencies are the preconditions to what is actually manifesting now. They're not part of what's manifesting now.
What's manifesting comes from the preconditions.
What's manifesting is interpreted karmically, I think. So that if somebody's uncle got bit by a snake and died.
Mm-hmm.
That karma is that what happened to that uncle is not part of seeing this object in the road right now, but it is carried into that object in the road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You could even, from the alaya point of view, it's like that story of my uncle getting bit by the snake is planted a seed in my alaya. So then when I see the snake, it's like the whole, you could say there's one seed that has like, snakes mean danger because my uncle was bit by a snake. You could say that's one seed that I experience it, or you could say it's several seeds, but that they always arise together due to karmic conditioning. Yeah. Yes.
It's inherited in the person, and it comes with the genetic makeup of the person, the thousands or millions of years of experience. The only people that are left to do that are the ones that imagine. The ones that didn't got bit and died.
Yeah, or you could say that's, yeah, you could say our karmic tendencies for being afraid of snakes and other things are, we're born with them with sort of this Darwinian trait, right? But I think we could, from a mind-only story, a Yogacara story, we could explain this whole Darwinian evolution in terms of alaya and rebirth. It works quite well. They match quite well, meaning that you know, alaya is this whole set of tendencies, and that in the story of rebirth, that's what's reborn, is this set of karmic tendencies. It's not a thing. It's not a self that's reborn. It's just a collection of particular tendencies. That's why particular sets can be you know, manifest in a particular lineage of qualities, and you could say those, everyone has been evolving, their alayas have been evolving from beginningless time to be afraid of snakes. So I think the alaya rebirth story is totally in accord, as far as I see it now, with Darwinian evolution. It's just a mind slant on it.
Right? Be afraid, the people that were already afraid were the ones that survived. The ones that weren't afraid didn't survive.
So right.
They don't make it. They inherit that thing.
Right. When we say inheritance from a rebirth perspective, inheritance is not a genetic thing, but a mind thing.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of saying that. Alaya is kind of like a an old story about genetics, we could almost say. It even has seeds in it, right? Yeah, it's kind of like, and from a strict mind-only point of view, it would say any physical things that you could call genes, you can't find, from because everything is mind, right? Or you know, you can find them. Of course, you can see them in a microscope or whatever, but what you're seeing is your projection of mind, and we have tendencies that have evolved towards agreeing that image is what we call a gene.
So the other one is inherited, would you say?
Yeah.
We can add to it.
Exactly. It's evolving all the time. We each have an alaya. In fact, every moment we're having an experience. We are having an experience every moment, even when we're sleeping. All of those are like planting seeds and they're shifting the shape of alaya. So you could say that's the reason why we're studying Dharma. We're studying the stories about alaya because this very thinking about these things is shifting the shape of our alaya in hopefully this helpful way. And so we're evolving. And then the rebirth story, a lot of people don't like the rebirth story because it's too wacky or something. But it works quite nicely, is that it's evolving and evolving, and then at the end of his life, the body doesn't support this. The body only lasts a certain time. The illusory image of a body. What about the real body? It's not a real body. But the appearance of a body, drops off, but this invisible, inconceivable collection of karmic tendencies manifests a new body. It kind of manifests an appearance of a little baby body, and that's why we can evolve. I mean, that's the classical Buddhist story. We spiritually evolve over many lifetimes. We've talked about this in the last class series too, but I would say just briefly that like we all have the individual unconscious called alaya vijnana, and they're unique to ourselves, they're our own experiences, and yet they're completely interdependent with each other. And you could say the way all our alayas are interdependent with each other is the collective unconscious or the interdependent alayas. And because we do affect each other in all kinds of ways, we're changing each other's alaya in all kinds of inconceivable and conceivable ways. So of course they're interdependent, and you can see the way we're changing them is affecting the whole planet and universe too. And knowledge is evolving on the planet and all kinds of things. So what exists in imagined reality is simply dependent reality. Projections of all kinds based on dependent reality. So maybe we could understand that as what seems to exist in imagined reality, like this. So this watch, exists in quotes in imagined reality, but it's actually really just dependent reality. It's just an appearance. It's a dependently arisen appearance. Projections of all kinds based on dependent reality projections are aspects of dependent reality emerging from alaya.
So are aspects of dependent reality different than misperceptions? What was
the imagined nature doesn't come from the dependent nature. It's a misperception of it. So again, we're making this distinction between projections are just the projecting secretions of thought, projections. That I think that we say does come from the dependent and is aspect of the dependent, but the imagined nature, the projected watch itself,
the assignment
of watchness, that doesn't come from dependent reality because it doesn't actually come at all. It's just it's just pure imagination.
It's based on.
Well, we're talking about projections, not the projected. Projections are based on dependent reality. So again, it's like, it's really this tricky point of imagined reality is the past participle, right? The imagined. What exists in imagined reality is simply dependent reality. And then you could even say dependent reality is actually just projections. Not the imagined, but dependent reality is projections of all kinds based on dependent reality. You could say the projections are dependent, or they're based on it, or they're emanating from it. Is it time? Maybe we stop here before the two truths. I'll just leave you with one little note about, we talk about the reification of a self, of a person, and the reification of the self of things, right? And the emptiness of the personal self and the emptiness of all dharmas. And that's actually in the sutra, it's talked about the two selflessnesses. We're not going to get to that, but I thought this was an interesting, juicy little note, a quote from Karl Brunhilsel. He's talking about the three natures. He says, what appears as this body and mind are the basis for imputing a personal self. So there's appearing, other dependent, body and mind. That forms the basis for the imagined me of a personal self. What appears as objects and consciousnesses, you could say the sense organs in here and the and objects out there, are the basis for imputing inherently existing phenomena. Isn't that kind of neat? So body and mind are other dependent phenomena on which we imagine me as a fixed entity, the self of the person. Objects like zendos and watches and things are the other dependent appearances by which we use to imagine that there really are watches and zendos and things. The other dependent appearing objects we make real things out of out there. So those two types of removing, or, you know, seeing through those two types of imputation would be realizing the two types of selflessness of persons and things. Thanks for hanging in there with these very complicated teachings. I think the sutra puts stuff in a difficult way. But I feel like we're unpacking it slowly. May any merit arising from this discussion be offered to the complete liberation of all beings. May they realize inconceivable freedom and joy in the vast ocean of eternal brightness. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. And dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become.